for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Flour, water, yeast, and salt, they're basic ingredients of bread. So simple. But as just about any baker can tell you, baking bread is an intricate balance of science and art. Writer William Alexander threw himself into both in a year-long quest to create from scratch the perfect loaf of bread, wheat floured, flavored with a crisp but chewy crust, natural sweetness, and an airy texture. Now in a new memoir titled 52 Loaves, he describes how he learned to create that perfect loaf. And William Alexander joins me to talk about life and baking bread. And thank heavens, that loaf of bread is sitting right here in front of me. Good morning to you, William.
Good morning. And you're lucky that bread made it to the studio. I had a fight off five or six people of your staff who wanted to fight it out of the way in.
I'll bet. And we're going to put the recipe for this loaf of bread up on our website. In the meantime, if you'd like to join us to talk with William Alexander about his new book, join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org, and you can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. In just a few moments, I'm going to have a taste of this bread, because William Alexander not only brought the bread, he brought a starter with him, and he brought a bread knife and this wonderful board. William Alexander, what in the world got you started on this?
Well, as a kid, I never liked bread. I grew up with Wonder Bread.
Yeah,
and Silver Cup and just horrible pre-sliced cellophane wrapped bread that bared no resemblance to bread. So as a kid, I never liked bread, and I thought I'd be the last person to ever be learning to bake bread, let alone write about learning to bake bread. And I don't know, about 7 or 8 years ago, my wife and I were dining at a restaurant in New York City, a very fancy place. And they brought over the bread basket, and I kind of moaned and looked for a sticky bun or something that I could eat. And not finding anything, I tried a piece of this bread in the basket. And I was startled that bread could be this good. I mean, the first thing that struck me was the crust. My first bite into the crust had an actual crackle to it.
Right.
And managed it almost to defy physics to be both crispy and chewy at the same time. And as you mentioned, it had kind of a natural sweetness that's developed during the baking process. And the crumb, which is the word bakers use to describe the interior of the bread, the crumb was every bit as good. It wasn't white bread, it wasn't whole wheat, but it had this wonderful yeasty smell and flavor. Mm. And it had these wonderful air holes and kind of an open honeycombed structure. And I just had never tasted bread like this. And as we got up to leave, I said to my wife, Anne, I said, I've got to learn to bake this bread.
Did you do what I did when I encountered the best English trifle I had ever tasted? I asked the waiter if I could go into the kitchen and talk with the chef and ask him for the recipe. Did you think of doing that?
I did not think of doing that. Most restaurants don't bake their own bread. They have the bread brought in. But I've been asked that question several times since. And in looking back, I think it's like if you went and you heard a wonderful violin concerto, and you said, "Yeah, I've got to learn to play that."
How do I do
You
that?
Wouldn't go backstage and ask the soloist for the sheet music. You know, there is a learning process that needs to go on.
You know what happened? The chef said, "No,
no,
I will not give you the recipe." So I did the same thing you did. I spent a year perfecting that recipe for English trifle. So I admire your persistence. I congratulate your family because they put up with it.
They sure did. They were troopers. I baked a loaf of bread for a year, and the same loaf of bread for a year. I was just trying to bake this peasant loaf. And I baked many, many bad loaves. I baked the loaf that was so bad, I couldn't serve it as bread. So I said, well, I came across this recipe for a soup where you put the bread in the bottom of the soup, and then you put a piece of fish on top. And I said, this will be perfect for this. When I put the bread into the broth, there was just this sound like... And in a moment, the bowl was totally dry, and my daughter Katie looked down and said, "Dad, what's for dinner?"
Oh, my goodness. Well, how much of a baker had you been previous to this whole process?
Oh, none. I had tried a dozen times to try to bake this wonderful loaf that I had tasted once, and I just baked a couple of doorstops. And then I went on to other things, to building a garden. And it wasn't until some years later, when the kids were finally out of the house and I had a little more time, I said, look, I'm going to attack this. I'm going to bake every week for a year. I'm going to do it the way I tell my kids to learn things, by, you know, having a schedule and being disciplined. And that was the approach that I took.
You know, I share your history because I can remember my dad saying to me, "Diane, you're not eating bread." And I had no appetite for it until I became an adult and tasted good bread. But bread goes back thousands of years, and you did research on that.
Yeah, I mean, bread was really born on the banks of the Nile 6,000 years ago. Now, this is risen bread we're talking about. Flat bread had been baked for thousands of years prior to that, and wheat had been baked prior to flat bread. And my theory about how the first leavened bread came to be was some tipsy chef was brewing beer, because actually beer came prior to bread.
And a little of the bread.
The risen bread.
Yeah.
And some of the beer spilled into the batter, and they had risen bread, and they said, this is pretty good stuff. Not everyone agrees with that, but that's the way I would like to think that it happens.
But you went so far as to try to grow your own wheat.
Yeah, I did. And I've been joking on book tours, telling people in the audience, I said, I can out-loco any locavore in this room. You know, I started by planting the wheat. I watched over it for 9 months. I harvested, threshed it, winnowed it, and ground it into flour with a stone. But I wasn't trying to prove a point. This wasn't a locavore type of thing. The reason I started was that I realized, that I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, that I was looking at a bag of flour, white fluffy stuff, and I really didn't know what it was. I couldn't relate flour to wheat. Now, the closest I'd ever been to wheat was flying over South Dakota at 35,000 feet, but I really didn't even know what part of the wheat it came from. I knew wheat was a grass, and somewhere there's a seed. So I thought, well, the best way to really learn this is to grow my own wheat.
How much space, how much room did you have?
I planted 4 garden beds, which were protected by my deer fence. And so I had maybe 150 square feet. I didn't have an awful lot. And the nice surprise that I found, it's very easy to grow wheat. The hard part is turning that wheat into flour. I'm convinced that if we all had to thresh our own wheat, we'd be a nation of rice eaters today.
So tell me how you went about that process.
Well, I couldn't find any sources on how to do this by hand because, of course, today, you know, it's all done out in the field. The combine comes through and does everything. And I ended up actually finding something by Pliny the Elder, writing in 77, who talked about a couple ways in fashion at the time. One was leaving the wheat on the ground and having your oxen trample it. And the second was using a flail. Now, a flail is two heavy sticks connected by a short length of heavy chain. My wife took one look at that and wondered with whom I've been hanging out and where. And so we ended up, first we tried a broom, which shows you how little I knew about wheat. The broom was totally destroyed in 5 minutes. Went to the back of a shovel. Even that would not free the wheat berry. I should mention that threshing is the process of freeing the wheat berry or the seed from the seed head. And believe me, it wants to stay there. You know, nature, it wants it to stay there. We ended up having to do it a handful at a time on a chopping block, holding one of my shop mallets, just banging, 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 and then taking what was left and stripping it wearing heavy, heavy gloves. What I think of when I think of that day is after about 8 hours of this was my wife, who was a real trooper, did a lot of it, flopping on the ground and saying, "Promise me one thing, next year you won't grow cotton."
The book is titled 52 Loaves. William Alexander is the author. Short break, we'll be right back. Welcome back. William Alexander is here with me. Previously, he's written The $64 Tomato, but the new book, One Man's Relentless Pursuit of Truth, Meeting, Meaning, and a Perfect Crust, is titled 52 Loaves. And here in the studio, he has a perfect replica, a perfect example of the photograph that's on the cover of the book, in that he has brought a beautiful loaf of bread and a plastic container of starter with him. You can join us. I know there are many, many bread bakers in our audience, and perhaps many of you who would like to become bread bakers. We're going to have William Alexander's final recipe on our website. William Alexander, tell me about the starter.
The starter is, this is about 14 years old. It was given to me by a retired baker. It's a mixture of wild yeast and bacteria and God knows whatever else is floating around.
What's wild yeast?
Wild yeast is everywhere. It is in the air. It's in flour. If you look at grapes and you see a haze on grapes or on apples, which is how I've also made a new starter, that haze is wild yeast. It's a different species of yeast from the yeast that we buy in the little foil packets. And I found this to really be the turning point in my bread when I started to use this starter.
But how do you collect it?
Well, the way that I made this was I took a couple of apples.
Okay.
I have a few trees in my backyard.
All right.
And I cut them up, and I took an extra peel, and I just put them in water. I let it sit for 3 days, and then I started to feed it with flour and water. And you stir it up, you get lots of air. And I actually talk about this in the book. I give a recipe in the book, and I also have a video of this on my website, which is 52loaves.com, and it's really easy to make. It's almost, if you just stir it and you get lots of air in the first couple of days, it's easy to make. It's easy to maintain. You only have to feed it once a week. If you've read about it in some other books, it sounds so intimidating and scary.
I agree, but it doesn't have
to be.
At one point, you tried to take a starter onto an airplane. Now, will you read for us from that portion of the book where you did exactly that and what happened?
Sure. Now, I should mention to set this up that the reason I was bringing my starter onto a plane was I was on my way to a medieval abbey in France that had been baking for 1,300 years, except for the last two. They had lost the last monk who knew how to bake bread. And they thought maybe I could come and teach a monk and to restore.
How did they hear about you?
Well, I had been trying, as I was getting in touch with the 6,000-year-old tradition of baking bread, and I was cultivating my own yeast and kneading by hand, and I had this urge to bake someplace really old, a place that had, you know, a long tradition of baking bread. And I'm not a religious person. In fact, I hadn't been in a church in years, but I thought of abbeys, because they're places that have been there for a long time. I was headed to France to take a bread class at the Ritz, Paris. And so I had been writing and emailing and faxing every abbey in France, hoping I could just come and bake a couple of loaves with their baker monk and maybe learn something. And it turns out that finding baking monks today is harder than finding a flying nun. I mean, they just don't bake their own bread. So when I found an abbey in Normandy that told me they had been baking until recently, since 649, I had said, well, perhaps I could come and bake a couple of loaves for you. Perhaps giving them the impression I was more of a baker than I was, and that I spoke French, which I don't. And as for the faith, I think we had kind of a tacit don't ask, don't tell policy. Well, they said yes, but they upped the ante and said perhaps you could train a new baker when you come.
Oh,
and
my.
This was absurd because I was going over to take a class.
Yeah.
You know, I was in no position to teach anyone else to bake. But I knew if I was going to give this a shot that I was going to bring my 12-year-old starter over, because I was really into baking artisan bread with, you know, using wild yeast and long, cool fermentations and long rises. So this is how I found myself at JFK trying to bring this this yeast onto the plane. And I was surprised. There's no rule on yeast, on dough. There's a rule on, you know,
everything
tweezers
else,
and
yeah.
bombs in your underwear, but
sure.
there's no rule on bringing dough. And I knew that this, I mean, you can see that this is a very loose, kind
yeah,
of a gloppy mess.
Right.
This bubbling, foul-smelling mixture. There was no way I was getting that on a plane. That I knew. So just before leaving the house, I had added a couple of pounds of flour to it to kind of stiffen it up so I could say it's not a liquid subject to the 3-ounce rule. It's dough. Well, it turns out you may as well yell gun when you get to TSA as say I have dough. It was sheer chaos. All the TSA agents in the area all wanted to get in on it and talk about whether I could bring in sour, because there's no policy. So finally, they took me off to the side. And, you know, passengers are piling up. I don't think any planes are leaving JFK. And I can hear people in the back saying, sourdough. He's got sourdough. I become one of those people that I hate to be behind at the airport. So finally, after about 10 minutes, they had waved me through, and supervisor finally came over to take charge. And I'll pick up from the book here. "What do we have here?" he asked politely but wearily. "Sourdough. 12 years old," I beamed. "A medieval abbey in France is expecting it." I tried to read his reaction, but his trained poker face remained flat. He started to run a wand around the container, which had stiffened into a plastic explosive look-alike due to the 2 pounds of flour in it. I told him the abbey had kept the flame of knowledge alive during the darkest of the dark ages, but after 13 centuries had forgotten how to make bread. This starter was the link to repair the chain. Still no reaction. Trying to straddle the line between pressure and humor, I added, "The future of Western civilization is in your hands." Just then, Anne, to my horror, opened her mouth to speak before I could stop her. The last time she'd done that in an airport, voluntarily reciting to U.S. Customs, unsolicited, every item we'd purchased and whom it was for, she sounded so forced and nervous I expected to be strip-searched. Bill's Bread won second prize at the New York State Fair.
Oh.
"Keep quiet and show some leg," I wanted to hiss. She was wearing jeans. He put down the container. Something else in my bag had caught his attention, something I hadn't even considered. "What's this?" He held up my small digital kitchen scale, which under the circumstances did a more than passable impersonation of a timing and ignition mechanism for the plastic accompanying it. At least I wasn't carrying any wire or the razor blades I use for scoring dough. "It's a scale," I said, "for baking bread." "You need a scale for bread?" "My mother never used a scale. More accurate than measuring by volume," explained. I couldn't believe I was having this conversation with a TSA official at Kennedy Airport. He took off the top of the scale. I never even knew it came off, and wanded. "Well, you get the prize," he said, breaking into a smile. "Strangest carry-on in the month. Have a nice trip." I slumped into the first seat I saw in the terminal, drained and sweaty. "That was close," Anne exhaled. "Not really." I pulled out my Ziploc bag, filled with small colored plastic bottles labeled shampoo, conditioner, lotion, and so on. "Do you wonder why I was bringing so much hair conditioner to France?" I asked. "In my carry-on?" Her mouth fell open. I could see she was a little hurt at being kept in the dark. "Some things it's better not to know," I explained. Anne, aware of the limits of her own poker face, agreed. "Well, I'm glad that's over with anyway." "Not quite. We still have to get it past French customs. Come, let's find the gate, honey. We're going to Paris."
So you got there.
I did.
The start.
And needless to say, I took the train down from New York for the show today.
I understand.
Wasn't going to try that again.
Tell me what happened when you got to the monastery.
Well, I didn't know what I was going to find there. And I thought when I first walked into the bakehouse, which was built in 12-something, and I saw this mixer built in 1930s, the bread kneader. Now, if you've seen them in the windows of bakeries, it's these big machines with a spiral and kind of goes in orbital action. This was just this wonderful contraption built prior to the Second World War with belts and chains, a huge copper bowl that rotated, and it had like a salad mixer action with a knife and a spoon and a fork that swung back and forth, and it would kind of stretch the dough up, and it would drop, and it would swing back again. I had no idea how to use this thing. All the directions on the oven were written in French, and and I thought that was going to be the biggest challenge. Plus, using French flour, which is very different from American flour. It turned out, though, the biggest challenge I had was, and I should have thought of this beforehand, it never occurred to me, these guys are running off to church 7 times a day. And I had brought over these artisan recipes with these long, slow rises, and I realized I couldn't use any of them. So on the spot, I had to sit down without any of the books I had at home or anything and try to figure out how to make bread that could fit into the daily
Schedule.
schedule of the monks.
Because they were going off to pray seven
The
times a
prayer,
day.
and then they had study groups, and the baker I was training, he played the organ in the church. They all had these other jobs. I mean, these guys were keeping a 1,000-year-old house going too, which, you know, being the owner of a 100-year-old house, I think I know a thing or two about. It's no easy task.
I've got to know the end of that story. Did you find a recipe to bake for them that they could then use?
You know, I always think back to the day where it was prior to the day we were doing the big test for the Abbey, and we had done a test batch and it had come out terribly, and the next day all the monks were going to taste the bread. And I didn't know this when I had first arrived. Then they were going to have a vote on whether they were going to continue this 1,300-year-old tradition of baking bread or continue buying the lousy bread in town. And I just sat there, and I'm feeling totally out of my mind, just totally out of water. And I started thinking, and I remember sitting outside the bakery and hearing the bells ring for church and watching the monks all drawn in. They looked like iron filings being drawn to a magnet. And I just sat there and I was just kind of like in a trance in the whole thing. And I turned back to my notes and I realized that all the stuff I've been doing for the previous year, and we haven't talked about it, but I didn't spend all that much time in the kitchen. I got distracted running around to yeast factories and seeing how flour was made and studying the history of yeast. And all these things that I thought were a waste of time, I realized had served some purpose. And I actually knew how to do this. And I sat down and I wrote out recipe for the monks.
William Alexander, his new book is titled 52 Loaves. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have so many callers want to open the phones. I'm really restraining myself. I'm going to have some of that bread, but I'm going to wait for just a moment. 800-433-8850. Let's go to Bono, Arkansas. Good morning, Steve. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
Good morning, William.
Good morning.
Diane, thanks so much for featuring this topic on your show, and thanks to William for writing the book. I can tell you're a good storyteller, and I'm anxious to read the work. I've been on my own quest for the ultimate loaf of bread for about 15 years, and having tried ceramic tiles in the oven, spritzing with water, putting water in the oven, I can appreciate your story of dealing with the TSA at JFK. And I finally have found what I was looking for, and it's simply a no-knead bread that's been, I think, popularized by Mark Bittman from the New York Times.
Yes, I had the good fortune or the bad fortune. That craze hit during my year of baking bread, and I really didn't think it was going to bake very good bread. So I put off doing it for the longest time, and I got so tired of people saying, "Gee, have you tried that great no-knead bread?" And when I'd say no, they go on to describe, you know,
how good it was.
So I finally tried it, and you know, the problem is it wasn't a very satisfying loaf of bread to make. Kneading is kind of like the foreplay of bread baking. You know, you could skip it and get right to the main event, but you might miss something along the way. And there's that moment when you first get your hands on, and I'm talking about dough now, when you first take the dough and it's kind of gritty and it's flour and water, it's not yet dough, and you do those first couple of turns, and all of a sudden it gets silky and soft.
Right.
It feels like dough. You do a few more turns, and it gets elastic. And if you knead bread the way that I ended up kneading, which is I I talk about in the book, using this starter, which already has a good deal of well-developed gluten, and you simply let the dough rest for about 20 minutes prior to kneading. This loaf we're looking at here, I only kneaded for 5 minutes. Huh. And it's fun. You put on some music, and you get to slam some dough around the counter. And so I think kneading's problem is it needs a good PR agent. It really isn't hard. I stopped using my stand mixer halfway through, and I just knead by hand for 5 minutes. And I think it makes better bread than the no-knead bread, and it's a heck of a lot more fun to make.
I fully agree with you. I love to knead bread. I love the feel, the weight of the loaf to be in my hand. So I'm on your side. 52 loaves, William Alexander. Short break, and when we come back, I am having a taste of this bread, and you will have the recipe on our website.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Hey, baby, where you going?
I really can't.
Well, the next Fresh Air, we celebrate the holiday with some great music by songwriter Frank Lesser. He wrote Baby, It's Cold Outside, and the songs for Guys and Dolls, and How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Pianist, singer, and popular song historian Michael Feinstein will play us some of his favorite Frank Lesser recordings. Join us.
My father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace roar.
So really, I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please.
William Alexander's website, 52loaves.com, you can not only see a recipe, you will also see a video showing you how to knead. You will see a photographic tour of the Abbey along with the bread maker itself. He also has asked the bread doctor, so that he can answer the questions that many of us might have. The book, of course, is called 52 Loaves, One Man's Relentless Pursuit of Truth, Meaning, and a Perfect Crust. Now, William Alexander, it's time for me to have a taste.
I believe so. So I'm going to slice.
What kind of a knife are you
using? This is a folding bread knife.
Folding bread knife. Mm-hmm. You couldn't take that on a plane.
You could certainly not take this onto a plane.
I don't think so.
Amtrak has a little looser rules
okay.
than planes.
So all right.
Slice into this.
Listen to that crust cutting through. And look at that. Do you have any flavoring in that bread? Any rye seed, any rosemary, anything of the sort?
I am kind of a purist when it comes to bread. This is simply flour. It has three types of flour. It's mainly white flour with a little bit of whole wheat and just a touch of rye. And it is made with my wild yeast starter, water, and salt.
That's divine. Mm.
Well, thank you.
It's divine. That's what I did first. I smelled it because
mm-hmm.
it smells.
It's almost
so
like
good.
Drinking wine. You know, you want to get a little bit of the nose first, and then
and
try it.
Someone has written. Forgive me, my mouth is full. Someone has written an email. Anita says, "I've been baking my own bread for a couple of years. I've had some success. I've never used a starter. Please explain why it may be better to use a starter instead of yeast from the store." Mm-hmm. You explain while I eat.
Certainly. I also put off using it for the longest time because having once been given something called friendship bread, which is, it kind of looks like a starter, and the idea, it's almost like a food chain letter. It gets passed around. You're supposed to cook it, and then you make twice as much. You give it to two neighbors who may or may not be friends. Well, we had this in our fridge once and went away for a week. We came back. The friendship bread batter had escaped the Chinese soup container it was in, had spread all over the fridge. Looked like a scene out of that old Steve McQueen movie, The Blob. And we ended up actually throwing out the fridge. So when I was given this 12-year-old starter, I think Ann just wanted to throw it out the window of the car. But I did try it, and it made in 1 week. I mean, the bread went from being lousy to being not too bad. I still had some work to do. The difference is that rather than using the kind of yeast that you get in the foil packet, which is all of the same strain, this is made from wild yeast, and the kind of tanginess that comes out of it is from the bacteria that's also in it. As I said earlier, God knows whatever else is floating around. But it's a different strain of yeast, and it gives the bread a different mouthfeel. It certainly improves the crust. Most people think that the bread will stale. It takes longer to stale when you use a starter. And, in French, it's called a levain, and some people call it a sourdough. But it's not that tangy one that we think of about on the West Coast, you know, San Francisco.
This is divine.
Well, thank you.
Congratulations. Thank you. All right. Let's go to Traverse City, Michigan. Gerard, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Diane and William. Thank you for the show.
Hi.
I am a 18-year commercial wood-fired brick oven baker using exclusively what we call natural leavens. And there are about 40 of us in the country, and we all started about 20 years ago because we knew that America needed good bread.
Good for you.
And at that time, they were flying bread over on the Concorde, if you'll remember.
I sure do.
And now we're creating in here. I think there's two key things that I would like to share with you really quickly here that you're kind of almost touching on. And one of them is all Homo sapiens, all human beings, have a hard time digesting grains unless those grains are first fermented. It's a key thing. We have found in our 18 years literally hundreds of people coming to us saying they can eat bread again because we are using the natural leavening techniques. And that's just dietary science. Grain is wonderful. It's a protein-rich food, but it cannot be digested by us unless it's first gone through that fermentation phase. That's why you have so many gluten-intolerant people today.
Interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know.
You've never heard of that.
Right. And it wasn't until I started baking bread that I realized that what we used to call the first rise is actually a fermentation process, not unlike that used in beer and wine. And it was when I started to pay more attention to that process is when the bread started to get get better.
All right. I want to read to you a poem by a very dear friend of mine, E.J. Mudd. It's entitled Bread. Mix flour, water, yeast, and salt. If the phone rings, don't answer. Your fingers are a sticky mess. Let dough rise in a nice, warm place. If the phone rings, don't answer. You're creating. Knead till satiny. Divide into loaves. If the phone rings, don't answer. You're sculpting. Bake in hot oven till crisp and brown. If the phone rings, don't answer. You're in aromatherapy. Take out and eat a piece at once. If the phone rings, don't answer. You're in heaven. Panis Angelicus.
Fantastic.
E.J. Mudd. And that poem is also going to be on our website.
Absolutely fantastic. And, you know, one of the things that I found that I'm a klutz when it comes to baking. I have no background. I'm not particularly good in the kitchen. But I did learn that anyone can bake bread better than anything you can buy. And it's not that hard. You know, it takes a little time. It takes a little tension. But with, you know, if you put your mind to it, you don't have to do what I do. You don't have to grow your own wheat and build a clay oven from, your backyard soil. But you can bake bread better than any bread you can buy.
Let's go to Wichita, Kansas. Good morning, Steve.
Well, this is Steve.
Hi.
I'm in Wichita, and although I'm an aerospace engineer in Wichita, the air capital of the world, I did take a class on diction, and we talked about you and your dysphonia and how I can see how it's most improved of your late treatment.
Thank you so much.
I started baking bread when I was in college, and we lived in a dorm, a co-ed dorm that had a kitchen, and we, a group of us would get together, and we would bake bread and take it upstairs to the lobby, and we had a lot of fun. I called really about low glycemic breads and the fact that plain white bread raises your blood sugar faster than table sugar does, and with some unfortunate consequences for fat storage and so on. But so I wanted to, if your author would put some information on there on low glycemic breads, such as rye and so on, and how starter for them is different, if it is, how he discusses it. And
well, now, hold on there, William. To what extent do you think you can talk about low glycemic breads? He's talking about rye breads, other breads.
Sure. And I was so focused on just trying to bake this one loaf of bread that I didn't do an awful lot with that. Now that I'm done, I'm having a little more fun. I'm making pizzas and breakfast breads and so on. But I think it's a valid point, but I'm probably not the baker to attack that one.
All right. Good luck to you, Steve. Let's go to Paula in Dania, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Diane. I adore you. When I was in college, one of my first papers as a freshman was some expository writing. I wrote like a 20-page paper on how to bake bread, but in English. And what, I mean, word for word, you know. But what clinched my A+ was I was a linguistics major. What clinched my A+ was adding somewhere in there that the word lady, L-A-D-Y, if you look it up in the dictionary, it comes from bread kneader, Old English. He was talking about the Middle Ages. Old English was 400 to 1100 A.D. And if you look up lady in the dictionary, it comes from bread neater.
Well, if I had a dictionary in front of me, I would certainly do that. But, Paul, I promise to do it right after I get off the air. Thanks for calling. Let's go now to Judy in Johnson City, Tennessee. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Judy, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. I think your ideas are wonderful, but I do want to represent, I guess I'm representing the people who have problems using their hands. You were talking about kneading dough. I got carpal tunnel some years ago, and I cannot, for multiple reasons, knead dough.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Right, yeah. And so for multiple reasons, first I started a couple years ago on a bread machine because Johnson City is not New York or Los Angeles. I'm from Los Angeles, where you could walk into a bakery and get artisan breads or challah, which I love, or New York rye. And I had to learn to start doing it myself. So people ask me, can you just throw bread, the stuff into a bread machine? I said, no. My mother taught me, and I'm seeing it true, you've got to know the dough. Right now I'm baking with a group online from Artisan Bread in 5 minutes a day. And two people can make the same thing, but it's knowing the dough and getting the end result. And I know that the no-knead recipes cannot do everything. Like bagels, I have a hard time with the no-knead recipes. They don't hold up with the structure. But there's a lot of things I've been able to do. And so kneading isn't always possible, and we have to find other ways of doing it.
Indeed.
Sure, and you can also knead in like a KitchenAid thing, or even in a like Cuisinart. But you have to do what you have to do.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Gales Ferry, Connecticut. Good morning, Jim. Thanks for joining us.
Diane and William, several years ago, a bread store opened near us, and we went to it weekly to buy. For me, it was a cinnamon raisin walnut bread. Absolutely loved that bread. And several years later, when the store closed, I found myself unable to face the thought of going to commercial store-bought bread and started to try to make something myself. Had no recipe, just went to whole wheat bread recipes and tried to add the ingredients that were in that bread. And after some successes, mostly failures in not rising properly or sufficiently, I was reading that adding things like raisins, walnuts, cinnamon, in fact, affected the rising. So I've still, the best success I've had, I bought a KitchenAid to try to do the kneading and wound up with a bread machine, which did the best. I think it wasn't so much that it kneaded it best, it seemed to control the temperature of the rising very well. But I take it out at the end because it was a round, hand-shaped loaf that I liked, not a regular size, regular loaf of bread. And I've just had a lot of inconsistencies. Wonder whether you have any suggestions on success in rising or if your starter idea is something I should be looking
for. Well, first of all, throw that thing out. You know, it makes the kind of bread you would buy in a store. It almost steams the bread. It leaves a whopping hole in the center. Some people use it to knead the bread. That's something that the previous caller might do. But please don't bake bread. It's just so easy to put it onto a stone.
It feels so good.
And bake it. And it makes better bread too. I think there are a couple of keys I'll just toss out in baking bread. First of all, weigh everything. Bakers weigh everything. Even the firewood in a wood fired oven that I went to visit, the wood was weighed out. Have your oven very hot. Use lots of steam in the first couple of minutes. And long, slow, cool rises. And those are the secrets to really good artisan bread.
No, when I bake bread, and I haven't done it in a long time, I used to put it in a wonderful ceramic bowl with a moistened towel over the top and put it into an unlighted oven.
Right. And that's the kind of classic, if you read some of the old books, the Fanny Farmer, you turn the pilot light on in the oven. And I think the current thinking is that you'll get better bread if you let it for ferment for several hours in a cooler place. And, like 68 degrees, 65 degrees.
This was an electric oven that had no pilot light.
Sure.
So it was simply in that enclosed oven, which was probably about that
temperature. And some of the old books make a big deal, too, out of keeping it in a draft-free place.
I've never
figured that. I've never had a draft collapse a loaf of bread on me.
The book is titled 52 Loaves by William Alexander. One man's relentless pursuit of truth, meaning, and a perfect crust. And I can attest to that. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure, Diane.
And thanks for listening all and learning. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.